Thank you. Chapters 4 and 5 tonight, the book of Judges. And I think we'll maybe get through them. There's just so much in these two chapters. They're wonderful. So we'll see how far we get. And if necessary, we'll finish off a few things next week. We've been talking about the book of Judges and this time period in Israel, which was sort of sandwiched between the prominent leaders that you had in Moses and Joshua, and the next time period where they start picking up a king who becomes a prominent leader. And now you've got this sort of tribal period of somewhere around probably 400 years and trying to make sense out of what the people were like and what the times were like and the things that drove them into this cycle that they had where for a while they would follow God and then they would forget about God and go under oppression and then a judge would be raised up for them. Just over and over again. And I think as we look through this, one of the things I want to emphasize is there's just a great lot of people lessons in here. You know, as we start understanding how these people reacted to things and the kinds of things that they forgot, the kinds of things that they did, they are really great life lessons for us as well. So I definitely want to keep that in mind. Before we start this morning, how about evening? David, would you lead us in a word of prayer, please? So after the introduction of the book in the first couple of chapters, the last week we looked at the first three judges. Anybody remember who they were? We had Othniel, and then Ehud, and then Shamgar. Okay, but now it's interesting when you pick up here in this chapter, beginning in verse 4, it says, then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. So it's almost like they skip Shamgar. I mean, what was he, one verse before? But as we mentioned towards the tail end last week, we have to keep in mind that this isn't all necessarily chronological, that there are times when some of the judges were co-regents in just different parts of the country, and so it's very difficult sometimes to get a timeline together. Here we get a hint, right? It says this happened after Ehud died. So we do have this this break here in the timeline with the next judge that comes along. But it says that the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Horosheth Hagoyim. One of the keys to understanding how to read these passages, especially with long words like this, just pronounce everything that you see there, okay? And just keep going like it's no hard thing at all. And nobody knows whether you're saying it right or not. So just a hint if you get called upon to read a passage like this. So we have now them being delivered again. So what's interesting, though, is it mentions Hazor or Hazor, depending on who you talk to about how it's pronounced, which is way up in the northern end of things, up on this side. of the map here. We're looking at Deborah then. Actually, we're going to see in a minute that she's actually down in this area in the hill country of Ephraim. So this is something that spans a pretty broad area as we start looking at these places. Now, if you go to the book of Joshua, it says that Joshua conquered Hazor and burned it. And now we've got a guy who's king again. How does that happen? We got an error here, you know, that we're talking about this thing coming up, and the Israelites had already captured it. Yeah, I mean, what we found as we were studying this earlier was that just because they went through and knocked out all of the major military establishments during the reign of Joshua, that didn't mean that the people actually moved in enough to occupy the place and to keep it, the inhabitants, from building back up. And especially under that constraint that we heard in the very first couple of chapters, what mistake did they make as they began to spread out over the land? What didn't they do? They didn't kick everybody out. And so some of those that they left behind were able to build back up. And here now, this guy, and again, the name Jabin, we see his name a couple times. It's probably a dynastic name. They call him the king of Canaan. Now, that's a little bit of a misnomer because Canaan wasn't a sort of territory like Aram or some of the others that we see read about. It was typically a collection of city-states around that area. But still, he would have been what we would think of as like the high king. Of all the other little kings around, he's the one that was the major leader. And now he is oppressing the sons of Israel there. And it says they cried out to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. Now, why is the big deal about 900 iron chariots? Okay, there are the tanks. Big military things, right? And they're scary. Why do you think police in New York really like using mounted patrols, I mean, I'm talking about on horse, when they're going out into a place like Central Park and places like that? They are. I mean, if you're on foot and somebody's on a horse kind of over you, that's kind of intimidating. Well, these things were chariots. How do you pull a chariot? Several horses, right? Usually it's more than one, at least a pair. And these are iron chariots, so they've got some mass to them, and also just the intimidation factor. Anybody ever watch a Ben-Hur? Yeah, you know, I picture these things as, yeah, they had the spikes out the wheels and everything, you know. So if they're going to go run over somebody, they don't have to run over them with a chariot. You just got to get close, you know, mow people over. And that's what they were for, and so they were very scary. And that became sort of the military advantage that the people had. Now, when we go ahead and get into the next chapter, in the Song of Deborah, as she's recounting things that go on there, we'll learn a little bit more about this. It turns out that when Israel kind of spread out, they really didn't keep what we would think of as a standing army. And so for a nation who got together, because remember, they don't have a central leader. They don't have somebody who's responsible for sort of collecting the taxes and paying the budget to keep professional soldiers around and stuff. These are little places. There might be the equivalent of a militia in a village sort of thing to mostly take care of robbers and whatnot. And so when this guy comes along with his armies and his chariots and things like that, that can be very frightening, and he was able to just sort of overrun them. But it says that now, in verse 4, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time, and she used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. And now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun." And we'll read more in a second here. Let's talk about the first part there. What do you find interesting about this in terms of just the questions that might pop into mind when you first read these passages? Okay, this is the first time we've seen a woman show up in this role, right? Now, do we have any other women listed as judges? She's the only one listed in this book, but are there any other mentions of wise women in the Bible?
Ruth.
Quite a few, actually. In fact, if you're catching up on your daily readings, you might have been close to one in the book of Kings when Joab was pursuing one of the folks who had rebelled against David, and he ran into the city. And there was a wise woman who called out to Joab and said, you know, what are you guys doing? You're going to destroy a mother in Israel. And using the phrase that's borrowed from this book here. And she wound up talking to city leaders and doing the right thing. You know, cut the guy's head, throw it over the wall. They all pack up, go home, save the city. So it's not like the Bible has never mentioned women and their role in things ever before. But here we see a couple of women playing a very strong role. And Deborah's the first one. Now it says that she used to sit someplace. Where was she sitting? Under a palm tree. What was the name of the palm tree? Deborah. It was Deborah's palm tree. Okay, so that should give you an idea of how well respected and known, you know, if somebody was going to go to her for judgment, what kind of judgments would people go for? Think about it for a second. I mean, we're talking about judges, but she's not really delivering yet. It says, but she is judging Israel. What's she doing? Okay, what were the judges supposed to do other than, you know, help kick the bad guys out? They were supposed to handle things like complaint. How did Moses, acting as judge, what did he deal with? In fact, he was overrun, right, with so many problems and things that his father-in-law said, you need some help on this, you know, and so he collected 70 men and got them all working together. Those were effectively the precursors of what we're talking about of judges. So she would help people decide issues where people couldn't decide themselves. They couldn't come to an agreement. They would go to her. What does that tell you, though, about the people in that time, in the sense that normally if you don't have a judge, you don't have someone who's going to be an arbitrator, how do people settle their differences many times? We see it every night on the news. Right? It starts getting into violence, and they didn't have guns back then, right? But, hey, knives were still working, and fisticuffs or, you know, cudgels or whatever it happened to be, there would be a lot of infighting and a lot of things that someone who was able and respected to make wise decisions would help to bring peace to the land. And so that's really what Deborah's job is she's helping to bring peace and to work things out here. And she's got a place that she goes to and people come to her. And then she summons the general. Now, when you look at his call, and, you know, when she calls for him, Barak, and it doesn't, I called him a general. It doesn't say that he's there, but he's called out to command the troops. And she gives instructions, and this is another thing that kind of helps us understand her a little bit. Does she say, okay, I figured out it's time that we need to kick out these guys that are lording it over us up in the northern parts? What's her instructions to Barak as he comes forward? Yeah, the Lord God of Israel. But what does that say about her? That she was having revelations from God. And we don't know the form of that. You know, there's a lot of people who say, well, how did she talk to God? I don't know. I can't answer that question. You can ask it all you want on a Wednesday night, and we'll let Mark answer it. It could have been in dreams. We've seen, you know, examples of that. It could have been through the Urim and the Thummim. We've seen examples of that. Any number of ways that God communicated with the people, but apparently he's communicating with her, and she says, here's the will of God. Now, Barak has an interesting answer. In verse 7, she continues talking to him, and he says, I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, and his chariots, and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. And then Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. And then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh. And the 10,000 men went up with him. And Deborah also went up with him. Now, everybody wants to decide what the motives are on Barak asking Deborah to go. Was Barak scared? Was he prideful? What?
He probably was a little scared, but
if you've got word from God that I'm supposed to do this, then you come with me and we'll get the job done. Now, it tells actually a lot about his character when she said, okay, but if I go with you, there won't be any glory in this for you. What's his response? It's not recorded here, but you can tell by the actions. What's his response? He went and called the people. He got them. So he's fine with that. He's ready to do the Lord's will. I look at him as a guy he's been called. He's got a job to do, and he says, okay. And if I don't get any glory out of it, that's fine too. But I think it actually speaks well of him that if he believed that Deborah was the one who was communicating with God, he says, well, we want you close, because if I need somebody to tell us what's going on, then I want the person who's got the line to talk to God. So they set out. It seems pretty straightforward. They're going to collect up their troops. Now, this is kind of a zoom in up north, because a lot of the activity is going to happen up north. They're going to gather here in terms of the troops that are going to come for the sons of Israel. And Hazor, the king of Hazor, is gathering actually his armies down here. Hazor is way up here. And so we got a bunch of these folks collecting down in this area, and that's real near the city of Megiddo. And there's just lots of biblical battles fought in Megiddo. And in fact, it's the place where, even as we looked at the book of Revelation, that it's referred to when people talk about the Battle of Harmageddon, that the battleground they're talking about there is the plains of Megiddo. Now, keep in mind, there's this river that runs through here. This is the Kishon. And there's mountains on either side, and so this big area here is flat. If you've got 900 iron chariots and you want to fight a big battle, what kind of terrain do you want? Yeah. How do you think these 900 chariots are going to do up in the mountains? Not so good, right? So he's going to come out here with his 900 chariots and all his troops, and Barak is supposed to collect 10,000 troops. Now, she only mentions two tribes here when she starts talking about Zebulun and Naphtali. And it turns out in the next chapter we see that there were other tribes involved in this region. Issachar is down in this area. Zebulun's in here. Naphtali is here. So there's a bunch of them coming in. Dan is even over in this coastal area. Manasseh a little further south. But when you start looking at this tribal area and them coming in, as we mentioned before, they're not men of war. You know, he's collecting 10,000 raw recruits. Can you imagine what it's like? A lot of times how you think about the wars that have been going on in like Afghanistan and Iraq are, I'm not even going to go there in terms of whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But one of the things that the U.S. has been trying to do is pull out by training the army of the people that's there. We have a history in this company. How long has this country had a standing army where we're able to train troops and field them when there's a need? A couple of hundred years, okay? Now, you say what you like, but those of you who have been in the military, you understand, they've got procedures for everything. There's logistics that people know how to do stuff. They can get stuff from point A to point B. They can feed the troops. They can get the weapons in hand. All of those kinds of things. They're a little different now, but they were the same kind of stuff that you needed back then, or you couldn't field an army well. One of the problems that they have in a new country that's never had a big standing army is none of that's in place. And so he's got 10,000 guys that are nice volunteers, but these are farmers, and they're showing up with their ox goads and whatever else, implements that they're going to carry with them, and that's what they're going to go to battle with against a trained army. Not sounding like good odds here, but and I think it shows the faith of these people that they've collected together. Deborah's told them to come. They've got a leader who's at least putting a plan together that they can all get behind. And they go down and they start putting themselves together. And it says that they told Sisera that Barak the son of Abinoam had gone up to Mount Tabor. And so Sisera called together all of his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosh Hagoyim up to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone down before you. And so Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Hoyagim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword, and not even one was left. So we had a big rout here. But We find a little bit more out in the next chapter when we go through Deborah's song. But spoiler alert here. What looks like it likely happened, she talks about the mist or the water falling and whatnot. This is a floodplain area here as well for this river. And in World War I, there were actually some battles were fought in that area. And one of the things that one of the commanders wrote down was kind of interesting. They said, with 15 minutes of rain, the ground became so soggy and mushed up that they could not maneuver any of their vehicles in World War I. And they basically had to abandon them in place. So what does it say when it says Sisera alighted down from his chariot? Which do you think, under normal conditions, would get you away from someplace faster? Riding a chariot with horses or getting off on your own two little ponies and running? I'll stick with the chariot, thank you, unless what? The chariot's stuck in the mud, right? Okay. And so that gives you a clue right there about what's happening. 900 big scary iron chariots. It rains. They go foraging across this field, and they all get stuck in the mud. How does that affect Sisera's army? That's pretty devastating, because suddenly your advantage is gone, and these 10,000 really angry farmers with their ox goads are coming at you in numbers. And it says that the Lord just routed them. And so they all started running. Once they got the momentum on their side, they chased them down and said they killed them all. You can imagine as they're running, it says they killed them with the edge of the sword. You know what? If they didn't have any swords, they did by the end of the day. Where are they getting their swords? Every time they get, knock one of Sisera's men down, you got a sword. You pick it up and you go. So the armies are routing them. Now, of course, Sisera is trying to hide. He's going away there. And it says that he fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my master, turn aside to me and do not be afraid." And he turned aside to her tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened some milk and gave him a drink, and then she covered him. And he said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and it shall be if anyone comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there anyone here?' then you shall say, 'No.'" But Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him and drove the peg into his temple. And it went through him into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted. And so he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg in his temple. And so God subdued on that day Jabin the king of Canaan before the sons of Israel. And the hand of the sons of Israel pressed heavier and heavier upon Jabin the king of Canaan until they had destroyed Jabin the king of Canaan. Now that's a great story. And there's all kinds, they make a movie out of that one easily, right? But there's a couple things. We talk about the Kenites. They were descendants of Moses' father-in-law. Apparently, they had pretty good relations with these Canaanites there because the man trusted. But not necessarily did they agree with all the Canaanites were doing. Was Jael aware of the battle and the war and the things that were going on? It seems that she was. And she knew exactly who she was hiding. And when he came in, asked for water. What did she give him? Warm milk. Okay, that's the bedtime ritual, right? It's like, oh, it's all safe here. Just go lie down. Now, I don't know about you, but, driving a peg through somebody's head, A, it sounds a little on the barbaric side, but B, I don't know if you've ever tried to drive a tent peg in the dirt, but this is pretty heavy labor there. So, A, she's a strong woman, but where'd she get that? She knows how to drive tent pegs. Okay, they were nomadic. They put up tents all the time. She knew how to drive a tent peg. So she used the weapon of choice, whatever was at hand. And just pinned him down. Now, when she goes out to meet Barak, this is the scene I would have loved to get. She goes, "Come on over. I'll show you the guy that you're looking for." And I'm sure Barak's going, "Oh, okay. He's secret away. Am I ready here? We might have a fight on our hands." And she's just kind of wandering in, and he looks down and goes, "Oh, yeah, okay. Battle's over. This one's gone." And that would have been the end of it. Now, of course, that was the general. But the armies are routed. It says that they pressed harder against Jabin, and they finally defeat him. And it all goes down the way God had intended it to, that through Deborah's choices and through the actions of the people collected there, following God again and doing what God wanted them to, they were able to throw out this much stronger force.
And this was a prophecy fulfilled by Deborah. She was a prophetess.
Yeah, and so you get there the exact thing that she had said earlier, which was that if she went with him, that the glory would belong to another woman. Now, it turns out she wasn't speaking of herself, was she? She was talking about Jael and what would come, the deliverance that would come through her hand. So I'm not sure what all of the lessons are there, but if anybody invites you into a tent to go to sleep, make sure that you're on good terms with this person, that you're not running away from an army or something there. Now, the next chapter, when you start looking at the Song of Deborah, hopefully we'll get a few things out of this. This is a great poetic thing, but if you look at it and all of the commentators, if you read about it, they'll tell you that the language is pretty tough in this particular chapter. There's a lot of archaic Hebrew, and there's some things that you have to kind of muddle through a little bit to get the big picture. But it gives us a lot of information about what life was like and what the battle happened and some things like that. So I want to spend just a couple of minutes with it. So it started in chapter 5, and it says, "Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, that the leaders led in Israel, and the people volunteered, 'Bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O rulers. I, to the Lord, I will sing. I will sing praise to the Lord, the God of Israel. And Lord, when you..." Oh, let's stop there for a second. Okay, so we got this introduction, the first three verses there. Who's it say this is from? It says Deborah and Barak. Okay, so I don't know if they're, you know, co-authors here or if Deborah wrote it. There's definitely some part of it that has a feminine hand here when we get to it. Absolutely. So we know that she's one of the authors there, whether this was just him helping her to make this popular with the people or bring it forth. That second verse, though, is interesting because when it says the leaders led in Israel, the literal translation there is locks hung loose, when the locks hung loose in Israel. Another translation I looked at said, when the long hairs were plentiful. Who would it be talking about with locks of hair hanging loose? Nazarites, okay? It's interesting when you note there's not a lot of talk about Nazarites in the Bible, but they were an important function, an important feature there. And first of all, remember, who could be a Nazarite? Who could be a Nazarite? Anyone could. The key thing about a Nazarite, it was voluntary under most conditions, right? Okay, we had a few examples where it wasn't, but they were just very few and specially pointed out. But under most of the time, it was a voluntary position. And what was it to do? Who were the normal people who could stand before God and serve God in a capacity back then? The priests, right? How did you get to be a priest? You were born and you had to be from the tribe of Levi, and if you wanted to be a priest in this offering sacrifices, it even got more specific than that. Who were you? Descendant of Aaron. Okay? Now, it changed some of his son's lines after that a couple of times as he went down, but basically, tribe of Levi to be in service there, and a tribe of, and a descendant of Aaron to be a priest. But we find that there were other people who were acting in a service capacity to God, and those would be people who volunteered. Some of it was for a short period of time, some for a longer period of time, and there were rules and regulations about it, and one of the rules that set them apart was what? Okay, razor could not touch their head. They grew longer hair, which tells you two things. That wasn't normal all the time for people to do that. And secondly, that it was set them apart so that people could recognize, oh, this is someone who has dedicated their life for some period of time to serving God. When the long hairs are plentiful in Israel, what's the implication of that? You had a lot of people volunteering to serve God. And so, you know, I think that's a point when it says that Deborah was helping to bring peace to the land and was helping things out. As things settled down and that knowledge of God began to spread, you wind up with leaders leading, with long hairs being plentiful, with people who were willing to turn back to God. And isn't that the condition that God wanted before he would send a deliverer to them? And so really this just all kind of feeds together here that there were people who were following God, who were taking on these vows, and that was a good thing in Israel, that people were volunteering to serve God. Now, it's really kind of interesting today because we're all considered to be priests. We don't have to be Nazarites in order to serve God, but you can kind of look at the ebb and flow of things of whether things are going or not by people willingness to serve God. And you see that? That comes and goes, right? Even in congregations, it comes and goes. But I think it's encouraging when you see something like this. It says, yeah, these people were following God, and that's what they wanted. Hear, O kings, and give ear, O rulers. She's calling them all to listen to what she has to say. And the first thing that she starts with is, I will sing praise to the Lord. What does she start out her song with? Praise. Thanking God and praising God for all that he's doing. Lord, when you went out from Seir, you marched from the field of Edom. The earth quaked, the heavens also dripped, even the clouds dripped water, and the mountains quaked at the presence of the Lord, the Sinai at the presence of the Lord, the God of Israel. Now, I think she's talking about the battleground there, right? And so two things to me, it sounds like, went on. So he's gathered out there with his chariots. They're all lined up, ready to roll on this. And what happens? Starts raining. And what else? Says the ground starts shaking. So I think there could be an earthquake in here as well. Neither one of those are real good conditions for chariots to operate effectively. And so what does Deborah then, as she says those things happened, where is her, you know, is this just an accident? Oh my, we were so lucky that day. That's part of the praise to God, isn't it? Is that God brought those conditions about. Yeah. Absolutely. So here's the explanation for the Lord routed them. He sent rain, and he sent an earthquake, and it just totally undid the other army in terms of their ability to pursue the plan that they had. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted, and travelers went by roundabout ways. The peasantry ceased. They ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, until I arose, a mother in Israel. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? Now, when you look at the first part, it says that under the days of Shamgar and in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted. Why? Why would the highways be deserted? They were dangerous. It wasn't safe to travel. Lawless. Until Deborah comes along and serves in her capacity as a judge. But when she says she was a mother in Israel, what do you think she means by that? Or in the context here, a mother in Israel. You could almost put a mother of Israel, right? What was she trying to do? I get the impression that she's treating them all like her kids, right? Okay, folks, we've got to straighten this out. And here's how we straighten it out. We're going to get things judged. We're going to get people going. We got the long hairs gone. We're trying to get dedicated back to God. She's on the path of straightening things out, and she is mothering Israel. And I think everybody understands what that expression means, right? She's trying to take care of things. A mother in Israel. And so these other conditions were bad until she comes up and starts working on them. New gods were chosen. Then war was in the gates, and not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. New gods arose, or new gods were chosen. I think he's talking about the idolatry that was running rampant and those kinds of things, and they had to make some changes out of there. But there's war around. Who's the war with? Well, we just read with Sisera and the army. How well was Israel ready for this? Not a shield or a spear was seen in Israel. They weren't any more ready to fight this battle on their own behalf than a man in the moon. But that's not what they needed, right? They simply needed to turn back to God and let God take care of it. And so when the times were ripe for that and the call went out, they did respond. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people. Bless the Lord. You who ride on white donkeys, who sit on rich carpets, and you who travel the road, sing at the sound of those who divide flocks among the watering places. There they shall recount the righteous deeds of the Lord, the righteous deeds for his peasantry in Israel. And then the people of the Lord went down to the gates. Who are those who are on the white donkeys and who sit on rich carpets? They're the wealthy. They're the ones who would have liked to travel the roads for trade and commerce and that kind of thing and weren't able to do so safely. And she's saying they ought to be really thankful for this, right? But who's she really saying are going to tell this story and carry on what happened? The shepherds. The peasantry in Israel. The common everyday people is what she's talking about. Those who divide flocks among the watering places. They'd all have to bring their sheep and things in together to water them. They would come from multiple pasture lands into a place. And what do people do when they get around the water cooler? This was the ancient water cooler, folks. Okay, this was the well. And they all talk, right? And they talk about the weather, and they talk about how life's going. And in this case, what are they going to talk about? The great deliverance that God sent, and especially through the hand of Deborah. So, awake, awake, Deborah, awake and sing a song. Arise, Barak, and take away your captives, O son of Abinoam. Then the survivors came down to the nobles. The people of the Lord came down to me as warriors. And from Ephraim, those whose root is in Amalek came down, following you, Benjamin, with your peoples. And from Machir, commanders came down. And from Zebulun, those who wield the staff of office. And the princes of Issachar were with Deborah. And with Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping of the flocks among the divisions of Reuben? There were great searchings of heart. Gilead remained across the Jordan. And why did Dan stay in ships? Asher sat at the seashore and remained by its landings. And Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death. And Naphtali also on the high places of the field. So she lists a lot of the people that were involved, a lot of the tribes. But now not all 12 are there. Okay, she lists several, but not all of them. And a couple of them kind of get called out a little bit, don't they? Who gets kind of called out? Yeah? Okay. And then who do you look at there that might have been almost slackers a little bit? First one talks about Reuben, right? It says, well, why did you guys just stay in the fields, you know, watching your sheep when we were calling everybody together? And then the second one was Dan. Where'd they stay? In their ships. Now, what that tells you is that there's a chapter in the tail end of Judges that talks about a Danite migration. Their territory was originally much further south, and they couldn't take it there because the Philistines kind of kicked them out, and they migrated north and were actually up in this area by this time of Deborah. And so Dan, by saying that in their ships, probably means that they were working with those who were along the Phoenician coast there in the ship trade, because those people were the ones who managed a lot of the commerce by sea at that time. And so Dan sounds like didn't really heed the call as much to send people over, probably because they were a little bit too integrated with the Phoenicians at that time. So those they got called out, but we had a bunch of others that came running, and she gives them all a shout out for obeying the summons. And then the kings came forth and fought, and they fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach near the waters of Megiddo, and they took no plunder and silver. The stars fought from heaven, and from their courses they fought against Sisera. And the torrent of Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. Oh, my soul, march on with strength. And then the horse's hoofs beat from the dashing of his valiant steeds. Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to help the Lord, to help the Lord against the warriors. Now, again, you get this picture of the Kishon River there. What happened, or what kind of imagery is she evoking there? Flash flood, I would think. You know, the waters of the Kishon swept them away. I think people in Texas understand flash flooding, right? You remember how we talked about this is down in the mountains here? What happens when you get a lot of rain in the mountains along here? Where does that water go? Right down there, right? You can be away from where it's raining and still have a flash flood, right? So that's something we know about. We've got to be careful here. Well, that, guess what? You know, if the Lord sent enough rain and just flooded that place out, you know, wash down and go. Now, again, though, I loved thinking about this because who else is on that plane? They're not all the Israelites. So somehow they didn't get washed away in the flood. And they're chasing the other guys. And so really, the other army has got to be looking at it going, this just isn't fair. Yeah, I mean, you don't know what all they were dressed in or what they had, but yeah, they're just coming out and they're following the general there to just run down into it. Now, could have been that they started out on the hillside, waited till the flash flood went through and washed the others out, and then came out, you know, and just kind of took over business. We don't know, but the whole point there is God set it up. God fought for them that day. The ones that were killed and washed away in the flood, whatever earthquake went on and the rains that happened, they would all look at that and say, my Lord is fighting for me. And know that the delivery was at his hand and not by their own. So, she makes it pretty clear that it was the help of the Lord. Now, there in Meroz, she calls out some others that didn't come and had some words for them. But then in verses 24 to 27, we have her tribute to Jael. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl, she brought him curds. And she reached out her hand for the tent peg and her right hand for the workman's hammer. And then she struck Sisera. She smashed his head and she shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet, he bowed, he fell, he lay. Between her feet, he bowed, he fell. And there when he bowed, he fell dead. So a little bit of poetic imagery there because the previous chapter says she waited until he was asleep and then went in. But the idea is it was at her hand. And she knew exactly what she was doing. And God was with her in that. So most blessed of women is Jael. Out of the window, she looked and lamented. The mother of Sisera through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariot tarry? Her wise princesses would answer her. Indeed, she repeats her words to herself. Are they not finding? Are they not dividing the spoil? A maiden, two maidens for every warrior. To Sisera, a spoil of dyed work. A spoil of dyed work embroidered. Dyed work of double embroidery on the neck of the spoiler. Thus, let all your enemies perish, O Lord. But let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years. So you like that last imagery there? It says, the mother of Sisera. What's she doing? Okay, now you got to remember, Sisera's the general, okay? It just goes to show you, doesn't matter how old your kids are, the moms still worry, right? It doesn't matter how old your kids are. I can tell from experience, the moms and the dads still worry. And she's sitting there thinking, man, this is taking a long time. And the picture she paints is, I'm getting a little worried. What do all the princesses say? Oh, don't worry about this. They're just out. I mean, they're going to come back so loaded with goods and, you know, and he's going to have special stuff. And all the time, she's worrying. And Deborah says, and thus it is, that those who come against the Lord, what happens to them? The Lord takes them down. And so when we get to the end there, let all your enemies perish, O Lord. For let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. Now, who's to love him there? Let those who love him. Who's she referring to? There's a general of anyone who loves God. But I think she's talking about all those people who ran out and obeyed the summons, not knowing what they were getting into, not necessarily knowing how to fight, not necessarily knowing how in the world they're going to win this battle. But they all went. And they did what they needed to. Rob, you had a hand. Okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in those terms before, but that's that. Yeah, okay. So be careful when you're looking out the window, especially if you're watching for something in all of those cases, right? Mark, you look like you're. Oh, okay. Any other comments? We're just about out of time, but we finally got it through there. Had to hurry a little bit, but it's a great story there, lots of lessons. And we can see that the times improved when people followed God. And I think that's kind of a general thing that may not be the political situation that you want or the things in life, but for you, times will get better if you follow God. All right, thank you.